Hello, this is Wes Fryer, and it is the 27th of January, 2012, and I'm in Edmond, Oklahoma, with Mike Sloniker, and we're going to talk today about Mike's life and experiences that he's had really in the last decade, seeing the Lord, experiencing the Lord, and knowing the Lord. And so, Mike, just as a way of introduction, you want to kind of share a little bit of a bio. You're recently new to Oklahoma, but you have deep Oklahoma roots. So tell us a little bit about yourself and how is it that you came to be living here in Edmond with your wife?
Okay, I was born in Fort Sill, 1945. I'm 66. I'm a typical Army brat, moved around with my dad and mom. And when I was 12, we moved from Fort Hood, Texas to Fort Sill. We lived in Lawton, so I went to junior high school, junior college in Lawton, and then transferred up as a junior to Oklahoma State, got a degree, graduated in 67, had an ROTC commission, so I was from 67 to 90 in the Army, and multiple of assignments, two tours in Vietnam, one on the ground and one in the air with helicopters, and then retired in 90 and went to work for Lockheed Martin. I stayed with them till February 2011, and then July of 2011, my wife moved. I moved back to Edmond. We both grew up in Southwest Oklahoma, and she has many cousins and aunts in the Oklahoma City Edmond area, and we decided to live in Edmond by us going back down to Southwest Oklahoma, and we came up here in faith, and. It's been one of the most amazing moves in faith I've ever seen.
Now, I got to meet you through our men's group that meets on Friday mornings. And, you know, just over the past few months, there have been things going on medically. And there have also been some pretty remarkable experiences for prayer, I think, that triggered a desire to say, hey, but can we sit down and have you share a little bit? But this stuff didn't just happen in the last few years, and you were telling me that a lot of this journey goes back about 10 years to 2001. So can you take us back a little bit and tell us what has your medical journey been up to this point, and how has the Lord made his not only existence, but his power and strength and presence clear in your life?
Well, in the morning of 19th of January 2001, before the inaugural parade for George W. Bush, I was asked to take the Odessa, Texas High School band down to Vietnam Veterans Memorial and kind of give them a little briefing that I always give everybody about what's down there. And, you know, I know the Vietnam Veterans Memorial very well. And about 20 of my friends in the local area, Maryland, D.C., and Virginia, were going to go help me. They wanted to help. Immediately when I got down there, I collapsed, and I was sent to the George Washington Hospital. They had to take over. What was astonishing to me is this group immediately prayed for me when I was in the ambulance, and then they went and did it, and they always thought they couldn't do what I did, and so it was a clear indicator that, you know, you're not the sole person to doing anything. Somebody else can fall in behind you. We got to the hospital, and they couldn't figure out what it was, but it was absolutely atrial flutter, where the heart has beaten one chamber and couldn't get it out of the way. It was disguised because I later had it again. Spent some time in the hospital. They went into my thigh and looked at my heart, found I had 40% blockage, which they call stenosis. And the procedure, when they came out, they didn't close the wound properly. So in February, there was a hematoma, a blood clot as big as as a hamburger. Bun, a hamburger, a piece of meat on my thigh, and they had to go cut that out. That gave me a hospital stay of 18 days. Got an infection in the hospital and couldn't get out of there. Had an enormous amount of people praying for me, enormous amount. And at the time, I was a high school Sunday school teacher. I did it for 13 years in the Methodist Church. The kids would come out and lay hands on me and pray. And one of the God moments in that is the roommate I had was terminal cancer, going to go to hospice, a Scientologist. The kids came in and prayed for me, and one of them, named Emily Miller, said, can we pray for him? And the guy next to him, And the lady that was brought the kids out said to him, would you mind if the kids do that for him? He says, no, I'd be fine with it. And so the kids laid hands on this Scientologist and prayed for him. Emily Miller at the time was 15. She's always a bright, inquisitive young lady. And so they laid hands on him and everybody went out. This guy wouldn't shut up all night long. All night long, he kept talking to me about those kids doing that for him. He said, no one's ever done that for me. On and on and on. And the next day, the caregiver came to get him, put him in hospice, and he told my wife, he said, nobody's ever done that for me before. Nobody's ever stepped up. It was a 15-year-old teenager. And she is a bright girl, but she's very independent and strong spirit. And it was one of the big teaching points of that. So I got out of that, and then everything kind of worked pretty well. And 2003, I blew out my left knee, so I had to have an MRI on it. And once again, I had the prayer, people come praying for me in the hospital. And then I had to go deal with the physical therapist. I call them physical terrorists. And you have to be disciplined to deal with this. You have to do what they tell you. Sometimes in the male mind, you don't want to do what somebody tells you. Because people were praying for me, I stayed focused on doing exactly what they told me to do. And I recovered from it. Working fine, everything's going good. Then on November the 8th, 2003, I'm helping with a Vietnam group of guys that are having a reunion for Veterans Day in Arlington, Virginia. And I collapsed again. When they came to get me, I had a 70 or 60 blood pressure and 241 pulse, and I was kind of bewildered. I was very bewildered. Got in there, and I was excited because I've always seen how they use the paddles on you. And I thought, I'm in the ER, they're going to put the paddles on me. And they put the silver pieces on my chest, and I thought, yeah, I'm going to see how this works. Because I'm a curious mind. I want to see if you come completely off the bed. And the cardiologist walked in and said, no, don't do that because you'll disguise the problem. And we went out and we tried to, they immediately knew what was atrial flutter, where the heartbeat's caught in one chamber. And they did an atrial ablation. What's significant to me is a Vietnam veteran, Dr. Tom Duke, performed that surgery on me. And in 1975, he was one of those boat people that came out of Vietnam with his dad, and he was a child. And it was significant to me to have a Vietnamese repair my heart on Veterans Day, November the 11th, 2003. Wow. And, of course, everybody's praying for me. But I just really felt like there was a God's message here of they're not the enemy anymore. And I never even thought about them being the enemy. But it was very significant. And Dr. Duke was a Christian Catholic. In 2005, excuse me, I blew out another knee, had another MRI. People pray for you. They pray for you before you go under. And what happened in that 2005, it dawned on me, you're not guaranteed you're going to come out of anesthetic. And, I mean, it was just made abundantly clear to me that every time you do this, there's a danger. And again, I went through the physical therapist thing, and that was that. 2006, I was responsible for Lockheed Martin's display for 3 days in the Washington Convention Center. Big responsibility. I thought it was easy to do, easy to coordinate. I don't have a problem doing that. But my body did have a problem doing that. And I had a hemorrhagic stroke in the right temple, right side of the head, right sphere. A hemorrhagic stroke is a bleeder. It's a stress stroke. And I got taken to the hospital. And what I had is I lost my balance. Got released on Saturday to go home. Did pretty intense Monday, Wednesday, Friday physical therapy. By Friday, physical therapy, I had my balance back. But I knew that I wasn't 100%. Had some more Monday, Wednesday, Friday physical therapies. Doctor told me what I had. And so I thought, well, okay, now we've had a stroke. The beauty of the stroke is that it revealed this is God's way. Well, I don't think it's God's way. It's just what happened. It revealed how bad my heart was because I had been compensating for atrial fibrillation, which is an irregular heartbeat.
Had this been identified before? Did they know what that was before this time?
No. they had many symptoms. They kept thinking it was flutter, which is caught in one side. Fibrillation is just an irregular heartbeat. And when I would feel it, I would stop what I was doing, take deep breaths, and it would go away. And I was compensating. And finally, on November 1st, 2006, I collapsed in the garage. And my wife went home. I called 911. They came and got me and took me to the hospital. We have a family joke. Because you inherit from your grandparents and your parents, I'm going to inherit cancer. I'm going to inherit heart problem. I'm going to inherit stroke, because that's what took my grandparents. And my wife has always thought, well, when you have the big one, big stroke, and you're in a wheelchair, I'm going to put you in little shorts and long black socks and little shoes with tassels, and I'm going to take you shopping, and you're not going to be able to get away. And so when she finally found out where I was, she came in and she said, I'd have gotten here earlier, but I didn't know whether to bring the black tassels or the brown tassels. And she joked about my situation. That's the relationship I have with my wife. I've been married 41 years. It's no slack. You got a problem, suck it up, go get it done. And this is, my wife is one of those pioneer women from Walters, Oklahoma. They're strong Oklahoma women. And so it's good to have a wife that says, suck it up. Because my mother always told me to suck it up.
But also helps you keep your sense of humor amidst some pretty stressful time.
Oh, yeah. And it showed me there's a light at the end of the tunnel. It may be a train, but I see a light at the end of the tunnel. So this revealed the atrial fibrillation, and then I passed out and went to the hospital, and we tried for 14 days chemically to get the heartbeat right, all kinds of things, and we couldn't get it right. And my cardiologist was a man from India who was a Christian, and he said, I don't know how to fix this. Fortunately for me, Dr. Catherine Bell was a cardiologist that looked at me, and she says, I know a way to fix this. And she got a hold of this doctor. His first name is Niv, M-N-I-V, last name is A-D-Odd, Niv-Odd. He's a expressionalist, no personality, perfect Israeli cardiologist. He performed M-A-Z-E, Maze procedure on my heart, where they stopped the heart and they realigned the circuitry is all I know. When I came out of there, I had a collapsed right lung, tubes hanging out of me, pretty well bewildered. I was in ICU, and I was just laying there trying to compensate what's going on, because when you got one lung gone, you talk funny. And I was bewildered. But the guys in my Bible study did a constant watch while I was in the ICU. There was one of them with me the entire time in this Methodist Bible study I ran. One, they just did like doing guard duty, like soldiers doing guard duty. And I thought, well, it's powerful. And I was released immediately out of ICU. Within 14 hours, the doctor says, he's too healthy to be in here. I'm thinking, I can't do anything. And they put me down in step down, which is the next step. And I learned how extensive all that was. This is not something you're going to get up and walk away from. You're going to have to do a whole lot of lifestyle changes just because of the operation. And when they crack your chest 7 fingers wide, you're intense about things. And I'm not a whiner, but man, I was thinking they really did a lot of work. And I had 6 weeks at home, recovered, went to cardiac rehab. Because of my curious mind, I wanted to see what is it they did to me. So they allowed me to go to the theater to watch open heart surgery on a quadruple bypass on a gentleman. And then I understood why I had trouble turning my neck left and right, because the nerves are harassed. Your chest is cut, is split 7 fingers wide. But what got me was that heart-lung machine, the $500,000 heart-lung machine. This is circulating my blood through my body so my brain won't go. And it's my body, my blood. And I kept looking at that blood. And a thought that came up to me is about the blood that was over the doors at Passover. Boy, when you see your blood, how red your blood is in quantity, like I saw in that guy. And there's a gentleman with a purple uniform on monitoring the levels. One mistake and you're dead. You're brain dead. And everything was just right there. The surgeon that was working on it, he was 36 years old when he finally finished all his training. He's an amazing doctor. And we're watching him. And
how I've heard a friend in Lubbock when we lived down there talk about, you know, some of these surgeries where they're able to take the heart out, operate on it, and put it back in, and the stuff that you just think this is not even possible. How long was this after you had had your surgery when you had the experience of seeing this?
It was November 15th when I had my surgery, and I was watching it March the 7th, 2007. It's curiosity. I'm just a curious person. And we had a cardiac nurse briefing us on what we were looking at. And a bypass is a bypass. It goes outside the heart. And I was astonished at seeing the lung and all that stuff down there. And the way they stop the heart is they put ice on it. It looks like snow cone ice. And that stops the beat. And that blood is moving. And then when they want to bring you back, they turn the heat up in the room. And you come back. I was astonished by all this. I mean, the mechanics to me, you know, I'm like a guy, the tools and, you know, Lowe's, cars and stuff like that. How does it work? And so I watched that, and by then I'd completed 36 sessions of cardiac rehab and gotten strength back into the pectoral muscles and all those places that were harassed. And, you know, kind of driving on, doing pretty well. But at the same time, that was 2006 and 7. Then in the summer of 7, my wife and I went on an incredible cruise from Rome to Barcelona. While we were doing that, I noticed that I couldn't raise my left arm to change a vent in the Mercedes bus where the air conditioning was. And that's when I found out I tore my rotator cuff on the left side. Had surgery on it. When I came back again, everybody praying for me. Again, you go under, and you need to understand it's a great day when you come out the other side in that room, waiting room. And then I got back with this physical terrorist, and that's what really got me. Because I take great pride in trying to be as strong as I can, upper body. And there's no way this 5 foot, 100-pound physical therapist is going to hold my arm down where I can't move it. And I couldn't move it. And it just I kept thinking, you're going to be able to move that arm. And what she was doing is it was strengthening the muscle. They were addressing the specific bicep muscle. The learning thing for me was, again, everybody's praying for me. I was calm about it. But I wasn't prepared to understand that never again will my left arm be as strong as my right arm. And that was hard to take because I know my knees aren't as good now. Let me explain something. I'm so driven that from 72 to 90, I ran 27,000 miles. I ran 9 marathons. My marathons were from fast as a 3:45 for 26 miles to 3:57. The 3:57 was in Marathon Greece to Athens, Greece in September and October of 79. And old dummy thought I did this all by myself. And took clear to 1997 at the stand in the gap that the Promise Keepers had with 700,000 men in Washington, D.C., for me to understand I wasn't doing 9 marathons under 4 hours by myself. But up till that moment, I thought, you know, I'm such a stud, I can do this. That's another revelation for me. But all that long-term running damaged my legs up pretty bad. And from 2003 to 2007, I had bone to bone on the left leg, left knee. And the doctor kept saying, you got to wait till you're 65 to do this. And I thought, well, okay, fine. But it was in constant knee pain. And you can wear a brace and you can take the pills, but it still hurt. The total knee replacement was another one of those gut checks because you have to take a pain management program to do the physical therapy because of the bending of the knee. You've got to get the flexibility in the knee and you got to train the knee again that we're going to bend back. I took Percocet, and you can't drive when you take Percocet. So I had 2 weeks of in-house physical therapy, and then Then they turned me to outpatient physical therapy, and I had to be driven to the place. And this is the time we had the 18 inches of snow in Northern Virginia. And all these women in the church would come and get me in four-wheel drive cars. Humbling. Humbling. One of them came in an F-150 Ford truck. Boy, I loved that truck. But, you know, I had to rely on everybody else to get me around. And I'm kind of an independent guy. I like to do my own thing. And once again, it was one of those things where you just shut up and listen. I'm helping you. Because my mother's always told me to suck it up and just keep going. And my wife shows me that daily. Don't be whining about anything. Just keep going.
But the addition to that in this experience was it was also be open to these people who are serving you, who are helping you.
What came to me is that the book 90 Minutes in Heaven. I recommend that book to everybody because, of course the guy is, he thinks he's been in heaven for 90 minutes. He's a preacher and he's in Houston in a car wreck. It's a tremendous book to read. But the big point that I got out of the book is you got to let other people do things for you. If they come in and see you and say, can I get you something? You're thinking, I don't want them to bother. At the same time, you got to understand, they want to help. This is the spiritual gift they were given of helping. And they want to pray for you. So you just got to let people do it. And if you don't want anything, shut up and tell them you want Motor Trend or Car and Track or whatever. Just tell them. Of course, a bunch of dummies thought they'd give me the Playboy swimsuit issue. Not now. But they always thought that was hilarious, you know. Because at the time, I was the president of the United Methodist Men. And a lot of guys thought it was funny, and I just thought, I don't need this book. I don't need any of this stuff. I just, thanks for coming by. But the beauty of all this is that you learn that you are not the focus point. God's actions are the focus point. It's not you. So anyway, that worked. And the only issue with my left knee is those TSA guys that I've had.
You set off some alarms?
Well, they just the process. Oh. If there's that microwave radar and I can get in with X-ray, I'm in and out. Otherwise, it's a hassle. And you just get tired of it. But it's the way it is. So we moved here in July of 2011 and started up with doctors. And the doctor I got, the super doctor named Gary Griffin at OU Med Center, he says, I showed him my physical that I brought with me. And he had a 3.2 PSA. And he said, well, you're 66. And yada, yada. Let's do it again. And he came back 4.2. And he said, I want you to go see this urologist, Dr. Sinwani. So I go to see Sinwani, and immediately, this doctor, assistant professor of urology at OU Med Center, a tremendous doctor from India, tremendous man, he says, he started asking questions, you know, and I said, well, I was in Vietnam twice. He said, well, are you on the Agent Orange registry? I got a mental block about Agent Orange and about the VA. Just do. And he kept pressing. And on the 29th of November, he wanted to take a look. I thought we were looking at the prostate, but he was looking at the bladder. That's a pretty intense thing for a man. You need to go see how they do that. It's pretty intense. You're having things done to you that you just, I wasn't prepared for the way they did it. But they had to go in and look at the bladder. So he did. And he saw it was inflamed. So he put me up for a 5 December procedure. I went under, I had a thing called cystoscopy. And they go into the bladder, and he started burning out places he saw that were cancerous. And again, my mind is just going wild because I spent almost 21 years with Lockheed Martin with sensors that go on attack helicopters, and I know about electronics. And I'm thinking, he's got all of that down in there, and he can take a sample out, he can look at it with a camera, and he can do all this. So he did all this stuff, and he put a stent in between the kidney and the bladder. That thing didn't feel good. So during Christmas time, I had that thing in there, and it was causing frequent urination. It was painful to sit down. I knew where it was.
And you were having to do things that talk about humbling and humility and having to... Was the fact that you had given so much of your medical care and your life up to the Lord important in this phase of your life? Were you... Well, were you sensing that?
I'm realistic. I'm going to inherit a stroke. I'm going to inherit a heart problem. I'm going to inherit cancer. When he said cancer with my name, carcinoma, I said, well, okay, I got it. And he said it was localized. It's in one spot. We're going to do this. And he took all these samples out. This is a lot of blood. You urinate a lot of blood. And for the week, it's going to be a problem. But if you understand this is the process and this is what you have to do, it worked out all right. We went back in 5 January. He burned out some more. And he did a lot of stuff. And he took the stent out. Then on the 20th of January, he told me, and today's the 27th, he told me, I got every single one of them that's in there. So now what we're going to do, as an Army aviator, if you got a helicopter that's got a problem, but it'll still fly, we call it fly it and watch it. And he basically what he said to me, and I mentally understood, we're going to fly and watch this bladder. This is what we're going to do. We're going to do a procedure called BCG. This injects tuberculosis bacteria into the bladder, and it causes the body to react to it. If there's any other cancer cells, the white cells will go after it. The doctor knows how to talk to me. He says, I'm going to put little soldiers in there, and they're going to take care of this, and we're going to keep checking. And it's once a week for 6 weeks, and the first one's the 14th of February at 9 in the morning. And so I'm completely calm with this. I don't have any problem with this. And the reason I have a problem with this, I know that people are praying for me. I don't remember which Sunday night it was.
A couple weeks ago, I think.
Yeah, I went to the healing service because Jim Kenney said I better be there. Jim Kenney's bigger than me. So I thought, well, we better do this. So I went in there, and the guy that's real close to me is Mark Tippin, and Mark was there with his wife. And the guy that's the choir director had us sing, I mean, a page and a half of songs. And I thought, well, okay, that's good, because I don't like to sing, but it's good. And didn't understand what that meant. When we started laying hands on, I've organized things where we laid hands on guys, but I wasn't the recipient. And I went over there, and people laid hands on me, and I don't know, because I don't know a lot of people, and First Pres, and the ferocity, the ferociousness of the prayers was incredible. It was like we were getting a fist fight with the devil. I was loving it. And I was really getting pushed around by these people that were praying for me. They were so intense. And I have difficulty breathing. And I got an incredible lung full of cold air. I could breathe a lot better. When I left here, I was absolutely exhausted. I was exhausted. And all I did was sit there. And we went home, and I just sat there. And for the whole week, I'm usually listening to the Doobie Brothers or Eric Clapton on my car radio, or that's the kind of music that goes on in my head, Stephen Stills. And for a solid week, I'm hearing the songs that the choir director played on the piano. I mean, it's constantly
The praise songs.
The praise songs. And I just thought, okay, you're getting talked to. Now, why do I know I'm being talked to? I had the honor of attending a thing called Manresa in Convent, Louisiana, 2007, 2008, 2009, 2010. I would fly to New Orleans and go to this thing. There's 110 Catholic men at this thing. There's 11 classes given, but the uniqueness of it is 65 hours of silence from 8:30 Thursday night to 12:30 on Sunday. We didn't talk. I'm around 110 men, and no one's talking. You can't believe how loud the wind is. You can't believe how loud he is to hear the birds sing. This is February in New Orleans, and 1 hour north of New Orleans, and it's 62 degrees. In Virginia, it's 17 and 20 degrees with snow. And when you sit on the levee next to the Mississippi River and the water would lap up to the side, it was loud. The little boats that made the big barges that go up and down, everything was loud. And you started understanding about shut everything down and listen. There's no way a man will ever have the moments I had at those four sessions I had down there where you can absolutely hear the silence. Now, you could sit there and say, God interpreted things and talk to me. What did he say to me? He said, the Catholics are reading NIV Bibles and they're marking them up. And I always listen to Bible studies where the Catholics don't read the Bible. These guys are reading the Bible and they were marking it up. And it was NIV studies with the notes at the bottom. They would ask to see my Bible, which was marked up NIV. They would just point at it and I'd hand it to them. These men were the recipients of their families praying that they would go. The first group of men I met was the grandfather, the father, and the son. The grandfather, I don't know how many times he'd been to it, but the son, who was about 60, had been there 30 years in a row. And the son was 30 years old on his first one. And the grandmothers and the wives and all the cousins, everybody were women, were praying that these guys would go. And I got a great respect for the Catholic religion. You know, and there's no way I'd join them, but I really got a great respect for the way they worship and the quietness of the chapel when we would go in for, we went to Mass all the time. And I just have a tremendous respect for what they do. The rosary class, the 14 stations of the class, and we had 11 classes. A lot of significant things happened there. The first time, these are Jesuits. The first time I went there, the priest was a Billy Vessels, born in Oklahoma, started preaching when I was born in 45. They just die as priests. They don't retire. And old Vessel was hardcore. And you're not talking to anybody. And I'm looking at this huge carved cross that's at least 8 foot high with Jesus on it. And I'm thinking, why don't these Catholics take Jesus off of that thing so we'll know that he's arisen? That was a thought. Vessels cranks up, throws his finger out, points at that cross, and he says, Jesus is never coming off that cross because we've got to understand the price he paid for us. And I just sat there and I thought, this is one of those moments. You know that you were the only one thinking it. And there's an answer right there. And so that was the beauty of the silence. You know, I don't need to be shown something. I believe it. But I was shown it constantly. I was constantly shown things that were thoughts. So consequently, when I sit by my house and can listen to this Oklahoma wind that's blowing forever and hear the birds and hear the stuff, I'm reminded, in my mind, it's God talking. Look, I kept you alive long enough to come to Oklahoma. We got a speed bump going on, and that's something that happened to your body. I didn't do it. It happened to your body. And these are the people that are treating you. And oh, by the way, that doctor's a Hindu. He doesn't worship like you do. But look how professional he is. And I've had that example slammed in me so many times. I don't doubt other person's religion, but my boss for 10 years in Virginia was a Mormon. He took care of me. A dear friend I had for the last 4 years there was a guy that was Methodist who joined the Jewish religion because he married a Jewish lady. And he's a very strong Jew. And he and I would talk about the New Testament. You don't do that in Lockheed Martin. And we'd sit in my office and we would go over. He'd bring stuff for me to see from the Old Testament. And I would say, well, you know, that's over here too. And he said, I know, I was a Methodist. And we discussed one thing that was so special. He has three children. The middle one is a girl who's now a junior or senior at University of Kentucky in Lexington. And she's challenging him all the time because she got around evangelical girls in her dormitory. And they took her to some services, so she likes to throw things in the face of her mother. And she comes in and she said, with the parents, both mom and dad there, I don't understand why you did this Jewish thing, because dad knew there was something special with the Christian way. And I just don't get it. And she walked away. And, you know, my friend would come and tell me about this, and we would sit and talk about it because it's, again, your children are trying to figure out what's going on. This is an adult. This is a 20-year-old young lady who is always feisty. And, you know, you're never not a parent. And you got this unconditional love. But there are times you just wish they'd shut up. And the beauty of that was he shared it with me. And he's a lifelong friend. Tremendous guy. So
the unity of the Spirit has been shown to you multiple times through yep. these different people who are seeking after the Lord, yep. and who are living out their faith.
But I agreed to do this with you because this is what happened to me. This is what I believe. I can feel it. I know people are praying for me. I know that. And I know that I have to slow down and let this process happen. And it's not about me at all. You're just a spoke in the wheel. And I think a lot about how you have to go through Jesus Christ to get to God. And that's really something that's going to be tough. Because you don't know when you go. He knows when you start and he knows when you end. You don't know when you go. And Ornelly Peters and I have talked about being in combat and making deals with God. He was fortunate enough to do that. I was too dumb to do it. And his testimony to me at Salerno in 1944 is profound. It's profound because he had the opportunity and the background to say, you got to get me out of this, and the Lord did. I had two tours and stuff happened all around me, and I thought it was because they missed. And it took clear until my 50s to understand they didn't miss. Somebody was taking care of you. So that's basically what I've got going on. I'm just kind of simple guy saying, you got a speed bump.
One more question to finish up. For people who are listening to this and, facing things that they don't understand and facing real adversity, there's a lot of bits of wisdom and advice that you've given and shared. Any closing thoughts that you'd share with somebody who's facing, loss with their family, unexplained tragedy? How do you recommend that we look at the difficulties and the challenges and the things that we can't explain that we face?
You got to understand that you got a basic component given to you that's called fear. And sometimes it can rule what you're doing. I would suggest that you take the power of that fear and you throw all those issues on an altar. Lay it on the altar. Every Sunday, when we finish the service, there's two people down below that you can go down and pray with if you've got an issue. You've got to take the first step and go down and talk to them and let them pray for you. And there can't be anything more important than that, because you got to let them do it and throw it on the altar. Make the first step and go down and do it, because you can't do this alone, and it'll eat you up, because you're going to think, well, what if this happens? What if that happens? This guy's the provider for the family. If he dies, do we have enough insurance? This is the mother of the three children. She's got breast cancer. I can't raise these children. What am I going to do? And you just got to go throw it on the altar. And if you don't make the first step, you're making a big mistake.
Well, thanks for taking the time to share your story. It's been powerful and appreciate it.